Jeremy Scahill and his colleagues at The Intercept have come out with a new book called The Assassination Complex, Inside the Government's Secret Drone Warfare Program. Ryan Devereaux is one of the contributors to that book, and he joins me now. Hi, Ryan. How are you?
Hi. How's it going?
Thanks for coming on here. First obvious question is, if it's a secret drone warfare program, how do you know about it?
Well, so the book largely draws from a cache of government documents that we obtained, and they relate to the Pentagon's program, drone warfare program, so it looks at operations in mostly Afghanistan and then the Horn of Africa and Yemen and Somalia. And so that's where a lot of the information in the book comes from. And more broadly, we've known about the Obama administration's drone program for years now. It's a sort of open secret that everybody understands is out there.
This is a program that many people may know is out there, but very few people know anything about, and we certainly never see stories about what it is doing. Can you give us an overall idea of its impact, whether positive or negative?
Well, it's a huge question. I mean, the program itself is really a number of programs that come together. The Pentagon has its own program, the military, and then the CIA, the Central Intelligence Agency, runs a parallel program. And these are sort of what they call targeted killing operations that focus on countries like Afghanistan, Yemen, Somalia, and then Pakistan. And they're sort of broken up between the Pentagon and the CIA, with the CIA taking over the operations in Pakistan, and those are covert and not acknowledged. And this has sort of become a central component of the Obama administration's foreign policy approach when it comes to counterterrorism. You know, Obama came into office wanting to sort of distance himself from the legacy of the Bush administration, the invasion of Iraq, and he set out to sort of do surgical pinprick strikes in places like Pakistan where the remnants of Al-Qaeda were. And, you know, drone warfare was a huge part of that. And in that time, the program, these missions have been shrouded in secrecy, with human rights advocates and journalists trying to understand the repeated reports of civilian casualties that result from these operations. And it's become a sort of defining feature of this administration.
So these eyes in the sky have replaced the boots on the ground.
Exactly. But it's important to remember that there are actual human beings involved in this process. I mean, there are, you know, informants on the ground. There are special operations teams that can work with, to sort of enhance or make these programs possible. And there's a huge network of U.S. personnel and contractors that make these operations happen.
So when you talked about the people who were dying in these places, and by the way, many people will be surprised, I think, to find out that we're not just fighting a war in Iraq and Afghanistan and Pakistan, but also going after Al-Qaeda and ISIS in Yemen and Somalia. Those are wars that most Americans aren't aware of, because they do not make the evening news very much, or any news for that matter, if people don't read The Intercept and other sources like yours. The question has to come up about what the military, I'm sure, calls collateral damage, and what we would call civilians being killed.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about that.
It's certainly a major issue, and I think it is a concern for many folks within the military. They don't want to kill civilians, but the fact is that these are programs shrouded in secrecy, and these reports do emerge from human rights groups, from journalists on the ground, of when these operations go wrong. For example, in the assassination complex in the book, which is drawn from the drone papers project that we did online last year, I looked at a campaign in Afghanistan on the border with Pakistan, a sort of multi-month special operations campaign aimed at the remnants of Al-Qaeda and the Taliban in the sort of Hindu Kush mountains. And over this multi-month campaign, nearly 9 out of 10 of the people that died in drone strikes or airstrikes, kinetic operations, as they call them, weren't the direct targets of those operations. So basically, the U.S. military with its intelligence partners would be hunting an individual person, and they would target that person, and they would kill them in a strike. But then there were a number of other people that would die alongside them in the course of the operations. And we don't know who those people were. These are very remote locations, and so the death toll grows, and we have, Al-Qaeda figure here and there, Taliban guy here and there, and then a whole host of other folks that die along the way. And there's really so little accountability and transparency in these operations, and that's what a lot of people have been up in arms about.
Now, I read a piece
over the last several years.
I read a piece that you wrote in March, Ryan, about the mm-hmm. White House saying in that month that it was going to release a report on the people killed mm-hmm. in drone strikes, including civilians.
Right.
Where's that report?
So that report, it's been pushed back week after week after week. Every week you hear, and I'll talk to sources, who are close to that world, and it's supposed to be this week. It's supposed to be next week. It really is supposed to be in the coming weeks here, but it's been pushed back again and again. The latest that we've heard on the report is that there's some sort of internal wrangling about classification issues, but when it comes out, it is likely to say, according to the most recent reports, that the civilian casualties over the course of the Obama administration in the different war zones that we discussed are somewhere around 100 people, which would be a fraction of what human rights organizations have documented over the years, which seem to indicate at the sort of highest estimates up to 1,000 civilians killed. So it'll be interesting to see and important to see what the Obama administration's methodology for determining that figure is. We're unlikely to get a really sort of detailed breakdown of where those numbers came from, but everybody who pays attention to this world is kind of waiting for that report to drop and see what it actually says and see if it actually says anything meaningful or useful.
I want to go back to the so-called Haymaker campaign, which you were talking about a moment ago in the Hindu Kush area, in which the drones targeted suspected bad people. I mean, suspected of doing some really, really bad things and potentially doing other really, really bad things in the future. As you pointed out before, the Pentagon doesn't want to kill civilians, but in some cases they feel like, well, we have to take out this bad guy. In most cases, it's guys. We have to take this bad guy out, and here's our only opportunity. Why, so often, is that their, quote, only opportunity?
Well, I mean, you have to remember that in this particular campaign that we're talking about a really remote region in a really sort of imposing territory right there along the border with Afghanistan and Pakistan. I mean, the valleys in this area have seen some of the highest rates of U.S. service members killed during the war in Afghanistan. This is not an easy place to operate by any means. So there are actual logistical challenges there. And a lot of the times, the solution that military leaders come up with, that U.S. officials come up with is, hey, you know, we can fly an unmanned vehicle over this area and we can watch people without, you know, having to insert guys into some dangerous valley. And we can get a pretty good idea that we think that we know who that person is that we're looking at, and we'll strike them that way. I mean, the fact of the matter is that that's just not going to work 100% of the time. There are all sorts of fallibilities that exist in that kind of a strategy.
It sounds like there's a lack of human intelligence on the ground guiding what we're doing from the air.
There is. I mean, often that's the case, particularly in some of the other conflict zones that we talked about in the drone papers that we wrote about, places like Yemen and Somalia. In Afghanistan and Pakistan, you know, Afghanistan, a country where the United States has been at war for a decade and a half, there are more informants on the ground, but then there's also the issue of how reliable those informants are. You're talking about people who are working for money, and, you know, they have a vested interest in coming back to their sort of U.S. handlers with results and with information, and so you can very much be at the whim of the people that you're relying on there on the ground to give you reliable information, and it's not at all unheard of in a place like Afghanistan for folks on the ground to sort of use the U.S. military's awesome firepower to eliminate people who they might have a problem with locally. I mean, that's kind of been the story of the war in Afghanistan in a lot of areas.
Has the drone program overall been helpful in reducing the numbers of Al-Qaeda and Taliban and ISIS?
Well, I mean, I think that you'd have to break up all of those groups individually. I think that there is certainly evidence that in the case of the tribal regions in Pakistan, in sort of North Waziristan, South Waziristan, that the drone campaign really did kill a lot of Al-Qaeda figures. But in Afghanistan, Taliban is surging right now. The civilian casualties in Afghanistan are as bad as they've been since the war started. And in, you know, in Syria and Iraq, you have, with the Islamic State, a completely different situation. So you have to break up these groups, by who they are and where they are and what's going on. There's no doubt that the United States has used drones to kill a large number of militants, but there have been tremendous costs to that campaign.
Speaking of the costs, I did an interview, and I cannot remember this general's name, but it was probably early in 2004. You know, we had been in Afghanistan for a couple of years, and we had been in Iraq for less than a year. But I asked him about whether what we were doing over there was not only taking out bad people, but perhaps creating sympathizers for these groups such as Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. There was no ISIS by name at that time. And he said, well, one of the problems is if you do it wrong, you kill one, but you create 10.
Yep.
Does that sound right to you?
I mean, it's almost verbatim what I a quote that I heard from a U.S. commander who spent a lot of time in northeastern Afghanistan. I mean, if you don't address sort of fundamental issues, I mean, this is the nature of conflict, right? You kill the wrong people, or you kill, you know, some folks alongside the quote unquote right people, and people are going to become upset. I mean, this is what war does. I mean, it's messy, and no matter how advanced the technology gets, we're not going to get away from some of these fundamental aspects of what conflict looks like and what it does to populations.
What do you think, if there were really transparency, if we had that report that the Obama administration promised in March and others over the course of the last decade and a half, what do you think the American public's response would be?
Well, I mean, I think a lot of Americans, you know, when they look at the drone program, they see it the way that it is portrayed, you know, by the administration as extremely effective, as extremely efficient, as, you know, and extremely sort of calculated and surgical. I mean, I think that they would look at a report like that, you know, if it has the sort of figures that we are hearing it's going to have, which are, you know, far lower than what human rights groups have counted. And they would look at that and feel reassured. But the fact is, you talk to people who've worked on these operations, you talk to people on the ground, and it's just not as clean as we're told. So I hesitate to think that people would look at a report like the one the administration is set to put out and you know, be critical or ask critical questions of what this program has done.
Talking with Ryan Devereaux from The Intercept, one of the contributors to the new book, The Assassination Complex, Inside the Government's Secret Drone Warfare Program. I'd like to get off that for just a moment and talk about some of the other stuff you've written about for The Intercept. And one of them has to be the question of what Edward Snowden exposed a few years ago when he went public with what the NSA was doing on the inside in terms of gathering information from people not just outside the United States, but inside the United States. And I wonder if that program that Snowden exposed has actually worked at all in tracking down the bad guys that we're supposedly after.
Well, I mean, I think you have to look at these sorts of things on a program-by-program basis and a case-by-case basis. And there's no question that with the, you know, sort of immense eavesdropping capability that the U.S. government has, that they've been able to pull off some impressive feats in sort of keeping this country safe. But you have to balance those against the kind of infringements upon civil liberties that Snowden's leaks also pointed to. So, you know, it's not a one way or the other type of situation as far as I'm concerned. I mean, I think that the national security apparatus is huge, and there are a lot of folks in there working every day to keep Americans safe. But there's a tendency in that world to go as far as they can possibly go. And in the sort of post 9/11 context, the national security state has been allowed or permitted or able to do things that in the past we would have sort of been shocked at.
And in that regard, we have to talk a little bit about the so-called terrorist watch list, which got a lot of attention again last week when the Democrats had their sit-in on the House of Representatives floor in which they were backing an idea to say, okay, you know what, why don't we make it impossible for people who are on the so-called terrorist watch list, the ones who can't fly, why don't we keep them from being able to buy guns? Why don't we have a policy of no fly, no buy? What was your reaction to that?
It's really complicated. So I've written a lot about the way the watch listing system works. We obtained the government's sort of secret rule book, this 166-page document laying out how people are added to these various lists. And to understand watch lists, you know, it's really complicated stuff. There are a number of overlapping lists that feed into each other. But the basic gist of it is that the criteria for getting placed on these lists is incredibly broad, and there's exceptions to just about every rule. And so over the last several years, there have been numerous cases, just case after case after case of children, lawmakers, you know, all sorts of regular law-abiding folks, largely, you know, law-abiding Muslim Americans being placed on these lists accidentally or for no good reason.
In fact, there was a story just recently about a seven-month-old who's on the terrorist watch list.
Right, right. I wrote about a baby that appeared on one of these lists, and you know, had the baby was going through the airport with its mother, had its diapers searched. I mean, this is an extremely fallible system.
But I think you'd agree with me, Ryan, that 7-month-old should not be allowed to buy an automatic rifle.
I do agree with you. I will take that extreme position. But I mean, you know, you have to. I completely understand the impulse there, and it makes sense. If these were lists that were actually comprised 100% of terrorists, then I understand why people would not want them to have guns. But the fact is, these are largely broken systems, and we're talking about, you know, sort of denying people rights that they are entitled to based on secrets that are. Or based on lists that are drawn up in secret with no accountability.
I will tell you, as a civil libertarian, the thing that drives me crazy about such a list is that you don't get on it because you've been convicted of a crime. You get put on it because you're suspected of possibly being involved in something that might turn into a crime, which is not how our Constitution is supposed to work.
Right. You could also be on it for having a nexus to somebody who is suspected of potentially being, you know what I'm saying? You can be quite far out from the thing that is actually under suspicion and be placed on one of these lists, and you won't know, and you have no form of redress for it. So it's a very dangerous place to sort of to wade into when we're talking about using that as a way to, you know, to sort of remove other rights from citizens. I mean, it's dangerous.
But even with objections from civil rights groups and others, I don't see any redress for this changing anything anytime soon. Do you?
Well, there has been since we published the watch listing guidance. The ACLU has had some success in some cases with the no-fly list. There have been reforms made in the redress process with the Department of Homeland Security that people can sort of petition to get off these lists in a way that they couldn't before. But by and large, I mean, people, the idea of a terrorist watch list makes sense still, you know, 15-some years after 9/11. But we need to take a closer look at what these lists actually do and how they actually work.
I agree. Ryan Devereaux, who with Jeremy Scahill and his colleagues at The Intercept have written or compiled a new book. Most of it is stuff that they have been covering for several years. The book is called The Assassination Complex, Inside the Government's Secret Drone Warfare Program. Nice job on the stuff you cover, Ryan, and I appreciate your time today.
All right, thanks for having me.
I'm Paul Harris. This is the Big 550 KTRS.